listening to The Leonard LoPate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
On July 27, 1981, six-year-old Adam Walsh was abducted from a Sears store in Hollywood, Florida, and was later found murdered. It led his parents to become activists for improved kidnapping laws, and their efforts paid off in hundreds of cases, but for years, their son's case remained unsolved. In a new book called Bringing Adam Home, University of Miami creative writing director Les Standiford and Detective Sergeant Joe Matthews recount the original investigation and how the case was eventually solved over a quarter century later. It's my pleasure to welcome them to our show today. Hi, and Les, hi. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be here again.
The book begins with John Walsh on Capitol Hill in 2006 answering questions about the Adam Walsh Child Protection Act. What did the act do?
Well, it established a national database for pedophiles for the first time and data sharing base that all states could tap into. Funded through 2010 and really kind of dependent upon occasional renewed funding from Congress to keep going. We hope they keep at it.
What was the situation in 1981 when Adam was kidnapped?
There wasn't anything. You could get the FBI to sooner investigate a report of a missing horse or a stolen car than go after a kidnapped child.
And that was the case here, Joe, wasn't it? But were the local police accustomed to handling cases like the Walsh's?
No, it was totally out of their league. And back then there was no recipe, no cookbook on what to do and how to do it. Usually the policy was you wait 24 hours to see if the kid was a runaway or not. But in this particular case, Hollywood, the uniform patrol did an active job of looking for a boy, assuming maybe, God forbid, he fell into a canal or something. And then it went downhill from there.
Well, there were 800,000 children reported missing on a regular basis. How many of them are stereotypical kidnappings? How many of them are runaways? And how many of them are the sort of thing that we see here?
That's a number that even today, but that number, the majority of them are runaways. The majority of those are domestic problems between husband and wife. Very few. It could be
About 100
that are stranger abductions.
Now, when the investigation began, the police were working on a tip that Adam had been taken away in a blue van, so they knew he wasn't a runaway.
Well, that lead turned out immediately or soon after to be false. It was witnessed only by a 10-year-old boy that was only outside about over maybe 2 to 3 hours after Adam went missing and after the police were already there. The Hollywood police decided to withhold that information just to keep the interest of the public, and that damaged the case.
In those days, there was no internet. So how did his parents get the word out that they needed help?
Well, they published a flyer. They got some help to Xerox, several hundred thousand copies of a flyer that then again through contacts and through the luck of having friends in certain places, they got airlines to pass out in Florida and then in Atlanta. And it kind of grew. There was a grassroots campaign that grew from there. But there were no such things as Amber Alerts or Kids on Milk Cartons or a Center for Missing and Endangered Children that helps law enforcement. None of that existed.
Did they offer a reward?
Oh, yeah, they did. $100,000 it grew to. At the time, the largest reward that had ever been offered.
Now, you said, Joe, that the FBI didn't get involved in cases like this. Is that because they aren't allowed to get involved in something that doesn't involve crossing state lines?
The only time the FBI got involved is if they cross state lines. And you have to have reasonable time to assume that the state lines were crossed and reason to believe that it was. Now everybody has a certain protocol that they all follow, and the first thing is to contact the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children. And that's the clearinghouse of missing children all over the country.
In 1988, the case was entered into a new nationwide database known as VICAP, the Violent Crime Apprehension Program. Was that a major improvement? Because we now are getting a national database to fight these kinds of crimes.
Not only that, but all the other NCIC, everything else that that has come about is all an improvement, and it's only as good as those agencies that participate. And if there's a case, and out of I don't know, lack of knowledge or laziness or something, and the information is not offered, then it's not going to do anyone any good. But today, we have more resources now than ever before.
Well, that was 1988, but Les, hadn't someone confessed to the crime 5 years earlier?
Oh, they had, but it was discounted. It was really a function of the I'm just going to have to say incompetence of the lead detective who was in charge of the case. This case could have been solved in 1983. The evidence was there. It just wasn't looked at.
Would the man who confessed, Otis Toole, have been a suspect if he hadn't confessed to it?
Not originally, because Otis Toole was in Jacksonville. Otis Toole admitted to a homicide that he committed in Jacksonville. And then his lover and soulmate and also a serial murderer, Henry Lee Lucas, he's the first one that admitted that he and Otis Toole traveled the country. And at that time, detectives from all over the country start talking. It was Otis Toole who was the very first person to incriminate himself by, I believe, thinking that he was talking to a Broward County detective, but he was talking to a Brevard County detective, and he admitted that he did something real bad to a little boy in Fort Lauderdale.
And he was in jail at the time.
On another homicide.
Now, you mentioned the lead detective. You said he did a lousy job, Jack Hoffman?
Yes, that's right.
Now, he told Jack Hoffman all of these things, the Sears store, the Cadillac, the horrific manner in which they'd murdered Adam Walsh. He was able to identify the canal where Adam Walsh's head had been found. Wasn't there only one person in the Hollywood PD who even knew about that spot?
Well, that's right. Hoffman and his partner were the only ones who knew that information, and his response was to accuse a jailer in Jacksonville, a sheriff's deputy in Jacksonville, of having fed this information to Otis Toole, but that man could not possibly have known this information.
But why would he do that instead of just do the obvious and say, okay, Otis Toole knows all this stuff. He's telling me all of this stuff. He's incriminating himself. He's the murderer.
I tell you what happened. He had a hypothesis as to what happened. He believed in the blue van being a suspect vehicle. There was a number of suspects that came to light that I had eliminated, and he had tunnel vision, and he wanted to generate his information that would complement his investigation, not the one that he felt was not involved.
Now, we've heard of other instances of something similar happening. There's a theory. Cops proceed on that theory, and innocent people wind up going to jail as a result. Why does this happen so many times when the obvious is right there staring these cops in their faces?
I think sometimes the obvious is not noticed.
But you're a cop. I mean, have you ever found yourself in a similar situation?
I would hope not. When I do an investigation, I look at every detail. I read every page. In 1996, the entire case file, which is unheard of, was made public through the Public Information Act. Everybody wanted to read it, 10,000 pages. I truly believe I was the only one that ever read every page of that report. And based on that, I was able to, you know, make up saying, okay, fine, this now makes sense. And I put in a chronological order. And then the answers are in the case file. If you don't read the case file, if you don't look at all peripheral information, you're not going to get it. And it was so much compelling evidence that I had found. And let me add another thing is the lead investigators, when they did interviews, they weren't investigative interviews. They were more like taking statements. And a statement is only the information that the person wants to give you. And right from the very beginning that they suspected Adam was missing from inside the store, and they interviewed a security guard, 17-year-old girl, that escorted Adam outside the store. So he was taken off the street, and they never conducted this intensive interview on her.
She took him out because he was causing a little stir?
No, not he. What happened is back then when the new video games were available, they had it on display. So the boys and girls would play the video while mom did shopping. Now, Revee was only within 10, 15 yards of Adam, but he was a very quiet boy. He was playing with another boy. She left him there. She went to the lamp department, which was right next door. And then two other kids from the street came in. There was an altercation. and the security guard, who this was her first or second day on the job, and her policy is if the kids are disruptive, you escort them out of the store if they're not with their parents. She asked the two boys that came in together, are your parents here? No, out this door. She asked Adam and the other boy, not Adam, but the other boy, if his parents were there. That boy said no. She told me that she assumed that they were together, and then she escorted them out of the store. The other boy walks off, and Adam's on the sidewalk by himself.
My guests are Detective Sergeant Joe Matthew and Les Standiford. The book, Bringing Adam Home, The Abduction That Changed America, it's published by Echo. The you spoke with retired Hollywood detective Larry Hosington. What was his connection to Otis Toole?
Hosington is a real gentleman. He was asked to drive the transport vehicle with Otis Toole in the back seat and just follow Otis Toole's instructions as to where to go. And that's it. Turn left here. That's when he turned left.
When they were trying to reconstruct the crime scene, check out whether Otis Toole's story was correct or not.
And Otis Toole led them to the right spot.
He led them to two spots. The first spot where he decapitated Adam, and the second spot, which was only a few miles down the road off the turnpike, is where he threw the head in. And during that time, while he was watching him for security reasons, he admitted it to Hosington that he had beheaded Adam.
Did he ever explain why he did such a gruesome thing? Rather, I mean, killing somebody is bad enough, but beheading him?
In the book, it describes in detail his motive, his opportunity, and his method. And it answers all the questions, every conceivable question as to why Adam was abducted and why he did what he did is all answered.
In the early investigation, the police recovered samples of carpet from the Cadillac and hair and several possible murder weapons, but DNA evidence turned up inconclusive. How much of the blame for the failures can be attributed to a simple lack of the kind of technology that is available today?
Well, what happened is they recovered the vehicle, and they recovered and took samples of the carpeting. But before DNA technology was available, I'm the one that asked for DNA to be used back in 1996. The carpeting and the vehicle were missing. They never found the carpeting, and the vehicle had been turned back to the original owner, and it was taken to a junkyard.
Hadn't a mother and daughter come forward claiming that Otis Toole had attempted to abduct the little girl on the same day that he took Adam Walsh?
Well, it was 2 days before. Adam was abducted on a Monday. On a Saturday, when he arrived from Jacksonville, the first thing he did is went to a Kmart. He saw a little girl the same age as his niece, and he felt his niece had abandoned him, and he attempted to kidnap her. I personally interviewed the mother and the daughter, and they positively identified Otis Toole. Yet when they went to the police and they told the police the same thing that they told me, it was discounted by the police.
Adam Walsh's father became the host of America's Most Wanted TV show. That's a big leap from being an activist for the parents of kidnapped children. How did that happen?
Well, I think in large part he was motivated by the sort of thing we're talking about here today. He just couldn't stand the incompetence and the indifference. And most of all, he remembered how lonely he and Reveille felt in the aftermath of their son's disappearance. They had no one to help them. No one seemed to care. And that's a terrible feeling.
And he, as a result, helped solve a lot of crimes, but still not the crime that was most personal for them.
And I think it ate at them for the 27 years that went on before they Reveille finally turned to Joe and said, please, for once and for all, will you help me find out what happened to my son?
So, Joe, why did they come to you? That was 2006.
In 1981, when Adam went missing, I was a supervisor in charge of homicide for Miami Beach Police, and I was the chief polygraph examiner. Hollywood asked that I assist them by conducting their polygraphs. The first person I polygraphed was John Walsh. I met John in 1990. I had a terrible investigation that I was working of a baby that we call Baby Lollipop, unidentified baby. John, assuming I was with Hollywood, but yet putting that aside, having his bitter feelings that he had at that time, he still came down. Then he realized I was with Miami Beach. As a result of America's Most Wanted, we solved their case. Now, that renewed my relationship with John, and that was the very first time that he and I talked, and we talked about the good and the bad and the ugly of that case.
Is it difficult to pick up a case that's 25 years old?
I think every case, the answers, on every cold case, the answers are in the case file in most cases. Now, when I say that, I've gotten admissions from family members, one particular family member that actually talked to Otis within 2 months of the time of the kidnapping, and he described to her in detail on how he abducted and murdered Adam. Yet, no one ever talked to her. But in order to get to her, you would have to interview three or four people. But the original person was in the case file.
Jack Hoffman really does seem to be a major screw-up, the detective who was the lead detective on this case. He accused another detective, Buddy Terry, of the Jacksonville Police Department of signing a book deal with Otis Toole. Why did he do that?
It's hard to say. As it turns out, there was a book deal between Otis Toole another person, but it was with a guy who used to work for him, whom he used to work for, who came to him in jail and said, you know, Otis, we could make a lot of money if we sold your story to the right people. Here is a book contract. Will you sign it?
And the story of a pedophile murderer?
Well, he'd admitted to over 100 murders, and he thought he could market this, he could peddle the story.
Did he really commit 100 murders? That seems unlikely. Most of the serial killers,
convicted
10.
Of 9.
Yeah. Otis Toole was an opportunist. Otis Toole admitted to murders that he did not commit in order to get some free time to talk to a reporter or talk to a police officer and have his chicken legs that he always liked to eat. And that's what he always demanded if they came to interview him. But Otis Toole was not only convicted of 9 murders, but there were a number of murders that proved positive that he did it, but it wasn't cost effective for them to prosecute him based on the fact that he's already been convicted.
On the other hand, the fact that he is such an unreliable witness, not only about himself and all the crimes he's claiming to commit, but also didn't he implicate his best friend who had nothing to do with this murder?
Absolutely. He followed the same pattern that most suspects do. The first time you interview him during the first session, not the first time, but the first session, they'll say that they weren't involved at all, as he did. Then he'll implicate someone other than himself.
Then I just was along for the ride.
Then I was along for the ride. Then I drove the vehicle. Then I held her down. And then I killed her myself by myself. And that was one of the mistakes that law enforcement or Jack Hoffman, he just didn't do an interview. He took statements, and the statements were self-serving.
Now, Les, your book makes no mention of anything substantial happening between 1996 and 2006 in regard to this case. Were there really no developments? Was nobody even looking into it at that point?
Sadly, that's pretty much the case. There would be every 4 or 5 years a newspaper would do a 5-year follow-up article, and that's about all that happened because the lead agency just had shelved it and really wished it would go away.
One of the sadder parts of this story is the problems that the Walsh family had to face on top of having lost their child. Some people accuse John Walsh of having mafia connections. Others blame the family for scaring children.
When a crime of this magnitude goes unsolved for 27 years, the frustration mounts. It's kind of like the Kennedy assassination. People begin to invent things, whether they make sense or not, in order to try to bring reason back into their conception of the world around them.
Did any of them suspect the Walshes of killing their own child?
No one ever took it seriously, but that's how talk happened.
But the Walshes, that's why they called me in from the very beginning, is to eliminate or to identify a suspect. And the first person I interviewed was John Walsh. I interviewed all the family members.
And you gave him a polygraph test, you say.
Not only a polygraph, but when I do a polygraph, it's not just I don't rely on the instrumentation of the polygraph. My interview with John lasted over 9 hours. And John shared with me everything and anything, any information that he thought might help to have his son returned. And I found John to be just a sincerely loving and loyal father and husband.
My guests are Detective Sergeant Joe Matthews and Les Standiford, who is the creative writing director at the University of Miami.
Florida International University in Miami.
Okay. And you pretty much wrote the book, didn't you?
Joe did the heavy lifting, and I tried to give it a context and make it readable to a general audience.
And Les is very modest. I gave him case study, and I gave him police reports, and he made it what it is today.
Otis Toole recanted his confession on numerous occasions as well, despite all of the details that he was able to recount from the case. How was the flip-flopping handled?
Well, it wasn't exactly as bad as you might think it was. Otis Toole admitted to 17 law enforcement officers, 17 different law enforcement officers from different agencies, every time he had an opportunity, that he had killed this little boy. Three times he recanted, one of which is in his recanting, he said, "My attorney says that I didn't kill that little boy, but I know I did." You know, any opportunity that Detective Hoffman had to withdraw him as a suspect, he wanted it and he looked for it.
Could you have given him a polygraph test and found out whether he was guilty or innocent?
Absolutely.
But don't sociopaths sometimes pass those tests?
Absolutely. But you have to – there's different types of polygraphs. And one of the most important things when you conduct a polygraph is the pretest interview. And in order – I studied Otis Toole, and I was going to interview him back in 1996. And I worked the case as a cold case for Hollywood at their request, not mine. And just before I went to Hollywood, just before I went to Rayford to interview him, they changed their mind and had their own detective. But one of the important things is, especially with sociopaths, you have to make it sociably acceptable as to why they committed the crime. And through the interview, if you do it properly, you don't even need the polygraph.
Mm-hmm. Because they reveal what's important, even if they're denying.
Or what's important to them.
Now, I keep on returning to Jack Hoffman because he just seems to me to be almost evil in all of this. He tried to implicate a family friend of the Walshes, Jimmy Campbell, in the crime.
Right.
Anybody but Otis Toole?
In 1981, pointed out, there was no knowledge of Otis Toole until he implicated himself in 83. Rightfully, there would have been no suspicion directed toward him.
Because nobody even knew who he was.
No, that's right. And it was not on anybody's radar screen in 1981. But in 81, Hoffman had developed from the outset a sort of novelist conception of what might have happened. And in the novel, you might say, that was playing in his mind, Jimmy Campbell had done it because he was involved with Verve Walsh. And it makes no sense any way you slice it.
He said that he was having an affair with...
Yeah, that's right.
And he killed the child.
And for some reason related to that, then he would have killed the child. Well, there is no logic involved, but he was stuck on that notion.
But once Otis Toole comes into the picture, we have his sister, Vanetta Cyphers, claiming that he admitted to her that he'd killed Adam Walsh. He even stole the murder weapon from her house, didn't he?
It was actually no. It was originally the murder weapon was there were two murder weapons. One was a bayonet, one was a machete. The bayonet, he was asked to sharpen it. It was his coworker's bayonet. After he sharpened it, then he had given it to his sister. He took it from his sister back. He used it, and just like the Cadillac, he returned it without her knowledge. And the same thing with the Cadillac. He had the Cadillac. It was repossessed, but he maintained the keys, and it was kept on the property where he worked. On the weekends, he would use it, fill up the tank from the gas pumps at the roofing company he worked at, and then return it. But the interesting thing, just like the bayonet, after he killed Adam, he never went back to take the bayonet. After he killed Adam, he never went back to take the Cadillac.
The Florida Department of Law Enforcement shot five rolls of photos of the Cadillac and the murder weapons. Were they available to you when you started your investigation?
When I never had an opportunity to do an investigation. What I did is in the different years, like a roller coaster, they called me in every few years when there was a different administration. But never until 2006 that I have the entire case file available to me. They would pick and choose, and they would give me what they thought was important. In 2006, I, like I said before, read every single page of the 10,000-page report, and I took my notes and I filed it and everything else. There was a damage to a vehicle that a witness who saw the abduction described, and yet I read someplace that a co-worker had dented that car, and I wanted to see if the timeline was right. I found that report, and now I'm looking for the crime scene photos from FDLE, the crime scene photos that when they processed the vehicle, and I didn't see them. And that's when I requested them from FDLE. I got 98 photos, and the Florida Department of Law Enforcement said to me, you know what's disturbing? Our protocol is when we get a roll of film, we develop into negatives, and we categorize the negatives until upon request we develop them. Never before, since the day this car was recovered in 1983, has anyone requested to look at these photos. They were never developed. I was the first one to look at them, and I was the first one to see what I did, what I saw.
Now, Adams Tool died in, what, the 1990s?
96.
How old was he?
Oh, my gosh, I remember.
Well, he wasn't an old man.
No.
He was 36.
I think he was close to 40 or 36, something like that.
And he was in prison?
Yeah, on the other seven homicides that he was convicted
on. He died of natural causes?
He died of sclerosis of the liver.
Uh-huh.
And he had kidney problems, all drug and alcohol related.
And but he was convicted of the murder after he died.
Not of Adam Walsh. He was convicted on seven other homicides.
Mm-hmm. So Adam Walsh, as far as the police records are concerned, that case is still unsolved?
No.
The case is closed. I'm sorry. The case is closed.
It's what they call exceptionally cleared. In 2008, as a result of Joe's report having been submitted to Hollywood Police and the Broward State Attorney's Office, they met and decided to exceptionally clear the case, which meant if Otis Toole were still alive, he would be arrested, charged with the crime. It's the Broward State Attorney's feeling that he would have been convicted and probably given the death penalty.
You say that there is a before Adam Walsh and post Adam Walsh era in America regarding child abductions.
This case is missing children as 9/11 is to airport security. That's how much it's changed things.
Les Standiford has written 15 books and novels, many of them bestsellers, including Last Train to Paradise and Bone Key. And Joe Matthews is a former sergeant of detectives and a 29-year veteran of the Miami Beach Police Department. They have collaborated in a book called Bringing Adam Home, The Abduction That Changed America. It's published by Echo. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for inviting us.